Hello.
Hi.
As you probably know, this interview, so that we can have something for the newcomers. And we were hoping that this would kind of bring you into a real perspective for them. So I think what I'd like to do is begin at the beginning, which is...
Well, that's always the place to begin. Well, I was born in Brooklyn on Clinton Street, which is on Brooklyn Heights, on March 4th, 1891. I was a doctor, and my mother was, well, we'll call her a young society woman, but that she was anything but a social butterfly. But I was the oldest of six, and the youngest one died after a year, but the other five lived to a good age, but they're all gone now. My mother was my mother and father were both very great idealists, and we were brought up in the very moral and spiritual background. Spiritual things mattered a lot in our family. And we went half the year to Vermont, and the beauty of the country was emphasized. But my mother was a very greatly loved person. My father was a doctor, and he had a lot of patients. Some of them didn't bring in any income. I remember my mother would she always laid out the bills and everything. And she'd say, "Now, Clark, what should we charge this family?" And he'd say, "Oh, I don't know. Let's wait till the next time they're sick and we'll think about it then." Everybody but me went to Cornell. And when I went to a school that had 2 years of college, it was called Packer Collegiate Institute. It was there on the Heights. And I don't know, I looked for a job the first thing after I got through college. A job at the Young Women's Christian Association. I was what they call girls' work secretary. I worked with the young children, the young members. I enjoyed it a lot. Well, marriage was I call it a sacred thing. I think with my father and mother, we were brought up that one man and one woman loved each other for the rest of their life. I don't think I had any expectations of marriage for my husband that he did not fulfill, except when he began to drink, of course. Well, he began to drink at the beginning of our marriage. But except in that one area, that tricky area, he was an idealist as I was, and we were really very compatible. When Bill and I were first engaged, he did not drink. He would go to the saloons, as we call them in those days, which we call bars now. He'd go and with the boys and order ginger ale. He had been told by his parents that his father, I don't know if they use the word alcoholic, but his father had a very bad period when he drank too much, and his grandfather before him, and that it would be a dangerous thing for him to start drinking. So he hadn't touched a thing to drink when we were first engaged. And then he joined the army. This is, of course, again, the First World War. And all the boys drank. And I didn't know that he drank, because he was stationed in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and I was in Brooklyn. And we got married because he was to go overseas. They had turned out to be a false rumor, but a rumor went round that they were going in a couple of weeks overseas. So we got married, although we'd planned to have a church wedding, we advanced the date when we heard that there was this possibility you might go overseas. So when I went up to New Bedford there to live with him, and there were loads of parties going on all the time. New Bedford was quite a social town, and they invited the young officers from the post, of course, to the parties. And I remember, it wasn't long after I was married that we went to this party, and I thought it was time to go home, and I looked around for Bill, and he wasn't anywhere to be seen. And I said, well, I wonder where Bill is. And one of the men said, well, we had to take him home. He had taken too much to drink. We taken him home and put him to bed. So they then took me home. And there was Bill with a big bucket beside his head. The boys had put him. Well, I was really quite shocked. But in one way, I wasn't too disturbed, because I thought living with me would be such an inspiration that he wouldn't need the artificial stimulant of alcohol. And when Bill started to drink, he always went to the limit. He never was a social drinker. He never progressed from social drinking to alcoholism. He was an alcoholic right from the beginning. He just went the full show. But he would always come home eventually. May have taken a long time. And he was never a violent kind of a person. He would just get sick and sleepy and go to bed. Of course, I was very disappointed about this, but thought I kept hope that he could. He was such a fine man in every way. Of course, I couldn't understand why his willpower wouldn't work. Mine would on things that I wanted to get over. I could do it. And he, at first, always thought that he could stop drinking if he wanted to. And he would think that he wanted to stop. But he didn't really. He would want to please me and try to stop. But he himself didn't really want to stop drinking, I'm sure, for many, many years. But then, finally, he did want to stop. And he begged me to help him. He wanted with all his heart and soul to stop, and he couldn't. I would rather have been living with Bill drunk than without him. We had wonderful times together. There were periods when he didn't drink, and we were very companionable and did interesting and had good times together. So they compensated for the drinking. I didn't think I was changing. I didn't realize I was changing until I finally had my own awakening. But for years I never analyzed myself. I took it all for granted. I'd had a wonderful bringing up, really quite an unusual bringing up because of the love in my family. And I just thought that I must be right, I must be doing the right thing, although I'd try something else, try this and that. But I didn't realize I was changing. I know I was getting tired of his drinking, certainly, but I think that I have a capacity to rationalize really above the average. I had to go to work and support him. First, I had this Young Women's Christian Association. That was at first a volunteer job, but then I got paid for it later on. And then I studied interior decorating, and I got a job with Macy's. I was hoping for the interior decorating department, or at least the furniture department, but now I was put in mattresses. And but then by degrees I got into the furniture department, and I was there quite a little while. And but Bill was drinking so badly that I asked for leave of absence. I thought I had to take him to the country to get away. He loved Vermont. He was born in Vermont. And he loved the country, although he didn't want to live there. So his sister and her husband had a farm. And they had told us we could always go there anytime we wanted to. And I wanted to take him up to this farm in Vermont. So I asked the superintendent for leave of absence. I'd only been there something like 4 months or 5 months, maybe closer to a year. I don't seem to remember exactly. But I had the nerve to ask the superintendent for a 3 month leave of absence. My buddies that were working there were shocked at me, you know, asking for a leave of absence. 3 months leave of absence. And surprisingly, the superintendent gave it to me. He asked me why I wanted it. And I said, well, my husband was ill, and I wanted to take him to the country. And he said, well, what's the matter with your husband? I said, oh, well, he's just not very well. And he said, I'm sorry, but I've got to ask you exactly, because I can't give you a leave of absence unless I know what it's all about. So I told him. He gave me the leave of absence. Well, the next year rolled around. We're in the same kind of a predicament. But I didn't have the nerve to ask for a leave of absence. So I quit. And I took him to the country just the same. But then when I came back, I had to get another job, so I applied to a department store in Brooklyn and got a job in the furniture department.
But did you find that with home working and taking care of Bill, did it affect your relationship with your friends or your family at all?
Oh, yes, very definitely. We withdrew to ourselves. We didn't see anybody. We didn't have any social life or any really family life with either his family or we kept to ourselves. I didn't want people to know about his drinking. Of course, he told me 1,000 times that he would stop, was going to stop drinking and would never take another drink. He told me that. And I have a Bible right over there where he signed the Bible. I promise you, my wife, never to take another drink. He'd done that for several years before he stopped. He really wanted to stop very, very badly.
How many years did you live with the active alcohol?
About 17 years.
17 years. So when Bill took that first step and stopped drinking, how did you feel? Did you believe him?
Oh, yes. I believed him entirely.
So what was it about this particular time, then, that you believed?
Well, because I went to see him, and he looked different. He was entirely different. There was something about him, about his eyes, that just shone. He believed that there was a God. He hadn't believed there was a God before. It was a spiritual awakening, very definitely. I just knew we never touched another drink. I just knew it at the bottom of his soul. I knew it, and he never did. And he knew it. We both just knew that that was it.
I'm sure Bill Sober was considerably different than Bill who had been active. And how did you feel?
Well, I thought I was very happy. As I told you, I rushed life. I thought I was very happy because I was working still and I had the house full of drugs and I had to look after them as well as Bill. And Bill never had any time. We had no time for the weekends. I should have told you during the drinking period, we almost always had our weekends together. You think of people drinking and drinking over the weekends, but the weekends, I usually planned something to do, something to take us outdoors, some hike, even if it was to ride the subway to the end and walk back as far as we could. And you see, I was working for it. I was trying to do the job for Bill, really, all the time. Thought I could do it. First, I thought living with me would do it, you know, and then I thought, well, I can make arrangements or work it some way. So I never released him at all. I was always sure that I was going to be the power behind the throne. I came to my senses that I could do the job. And this was, of course, after he sobered. And it was quite a while after he had his own spiritual experience. But he was so busy with all his other friends, and we'd had these wonderful times together, and he didn't have any opportunity for any of these weekends or anything, any companionship with me anymore. He had only his bums that he got off the street to work with, and I didn't know where I fitted in. I'd been a very important person before. The whole family, our little unit of a family, depended upon me. I had to earn the living and make all the decisions and do everything. And now I wasn't really needed anymore. I didn't know where I stood. This, as I say, I covered up with my rationalization that he was sober and everything was fine. It was happy. And it wasn't until one day he said to me, let's hurry up now and get ready to go to the meetings. We were to go to the Oxford Group meeting that day. And he said, hurry up, let's get ready. And at that simple remark, I don't know why, but I lost my temper. I've always had a temper. That's been one of my great difficulties in fighting is that I do something that I'm sorry for, and then of course it goes. And this time I had a shoe in my hand, and I threw the shoe at him just as hard as I could, and I said, damn your old meetings. And I was more surprised at myself than he was at that show of temper. At such a slight remark of his, I hadn't realized all these other things that were accumulating within me. So it took me a long time to analyze it, but I began to analyze myself. As I said before, I'd always take myself for granted. I thought because my motives, I thought, were good, I thought that I must be on the credit side and he was on the debit side. I began to think about myself for the first time, as I say, and analyze why I did these things. And I realized that I was full of resentment at these other people, that I was felt talking about being put on a shelf. I felt put on the shelf, that I wasn't needed anymore, and I didn't really know what to do. So I finally decided that I better live by these very same principles that Bill did. That was my spiritual awakening. And I really believe that that's That's the start of Aladdin, I believe. And although it took a lot of other people having the same kind of an experience that I did to get any momentum to it, but I think the early people, Addie Smith and others, way back before there was any organization or fellowship, we people who recognized the fact that we had to change our lives and to live by these principles that Bill did.
These principles that you're talking about that evolved into the AA
12-step.
And also the Al-Anon 12-step.
Yes.
Were they originally, these steps, were they derived from the Oxford group?
Yes. The Oxford group had the six principles, although they didn't number them. They had certain ideas that people tried to run their life by. They were to take periodically or daily to take a moral inventory of yourself, to hand your life over to God, to try and make a restitution for any harm that you had done to people, and to use these principles in all your affairs, not only on Sunday, but every day in every way. And that's what Bill was using when he was working with the alcoholics and the before AA really got to be all born, actually. I mean, it actually was born, but before it was organized or compacted, so it made a fellowship. I went along with Bill to his meetings. We went every week to these meetings of the Oxford group. And I went along with him just because that's what a wife did. She accompanied her husband. I didn't go for my sake. I went for his sake until I had this little awakening that I had on my own that recognized that I needed it. But I never did. Well, I never did really become a good Oxford group member. You can't talk about Aldon in the beginning without referring to AA, because AA was the mother, we'll say, it was the tree of which Al-Anon is a branch, really. Because we got the principles and we got the whole idea of the spirituality and everything from AA. So that in the early days of AA, there was no literature. And people had to travel from place to place to start a new group. There was no other way of doing it. You had to go. So Bill and I went. And we sometimes we go in some old jalopy, and 7 or 8 of us would pile in, you know, to a car that wasn't meant to hold more than 5 or 4 or something. Go to Philadelphia or to Washington or out to Akron or to Cleveland or around places. And Bill would talk to the AAs, of course, and the families would all gather together and invite me to a reception. At first it was just we just gossip and talk and drink tea, and then by degrees we got to telling each other about, and I got telling them about how I'd found that I needed the principles of AA just as much as Bill did, only for different reasons, and how I'd been trying to live them. so that other people would get up and tell about how they had come to that same conclusion. So by going around to group, more and more families got interested in doing something about their own reactions. So that later, this started in 35 or 36, way back before the book came out. The AA book came out in 39. But in 49, something like that, after the AA had been going for quite a little while, Gil thought it was time that they had a conference of delegates to really run AA, that having a central office isolated by itself was going to make it seem as if it were authoritative and giving orders to AA, and that is something that no AA would take would be orders. So AA should be run by the individuals in AA. So he went around the country to all the different groups to ask them if they agreed with him about the having a conference of delegates that would come annually to New York to decide on the policies that it would use, that and to hear the reports of what it had done so far and the financial reports, be managers of their own society. So they all said yes, they all wanted to do it. So when he came back, he decided to, you know, start this conference of delegates. But on this trip, he was surprised to find so many gatherings of the families of alcoholics. They were in lots of different places. So he told me about it and said he thought they should be unified so that they could be a fellowship also and have the same, be unified by having all the same principles, and where any desperate wife could call up and find out whether there was a group and do certain things that we needed, that Al-Anon needed a central office. Of course, it wasn't called Al-Anon then, it was called the family groups. But the families needed a central office where they could get information. So he suggested I sought such a thing. Well, to be perfectly honest, I didn't want to do it. I wanted to work in my garden. We'd been living around, we hadn't any home. We left Clinton Street, Brooklyn, in 39, and we had no place to go except as visitors at innumerable AAs. So for 2 years, I think it was, we went from pillar to post without any real home. And then I came up here in 41, and I was just so happy in my having a place of my own that I didn't want to take the time out to. But then when I began to think about it and see what the need was and everything, I saw, of course, this is a very important thing that needs to be done. So Anne was a neighbor to help me out. We got 87 names from AA. 87 was really quite a tremendous number, I think, for people, either groups of the families of alcoholics or individual wives. And I call them wives with because there were very few women in AA, and they were all, the alcoholics were mostly men. Only one or two women. So all the spouses of alcoholics were wives at that time. So there were these groups of, all these groups of wives. And we wrote to the 87 that had written to the AA office and asked them if they would like to form a fellowship of the families of alcoholics. We got back 50 answers, which was pretty good as a in proportion, I think. So Al-Anon really started with 50 Al-Anon groups. And then we wrote the various principles out as we thought, as we came to them, about first about the name and about then the principles and whether they want to adopt AA's principles. And Ann and I sent out these questionnaires asking these 50 groups whether they approved of such and such a thing. And they all seemed to do it. We got quite a few answers. And then one man, Sam, his name was, and he came from a small town in Massachusetts. And he was a male family member. His wife was alcoholic. He was one that had answered, and he sent us $10. That's the first money that we ever got, and it came unsolicited. Then we sent out appeals for money. We started to send out appeals for money and got started in getting in some voluntary contributions. This was early 51. He asked them about the name, if they would like Al-Anon. We took the first two syllables of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al and Anon. They said they wanted that name. But it's the Al-Anon family groups.
One of the basic principles is loving detachment. Where did that evolve from? It's such a remarkable concept.
To live your own life. That you could never run anybody else's life. That was one of our early principles, that you could only manage your own life. And it might have a side effect of affecting that other person. In fact, it was bound to have. But that wasn't for you to work on. You couldn't help anybody unless you first help yourself. You had to be what you were talking about. I really am a student of my husband's philosophy in AA. And Bill had big ideas. People keep saying, wouldn't Bill be surprised to see it? No, he wouldn't. He expected it. I believe it's a spiritual movement, both AA and Al-Anon, and I think the world needs it terrifically. And that as long as we feel we have a spiritual mission, that it'll keep on going. I said out there in Akron that the future, I think that the AA and Al-Anon, because there is the three big A's, AA, Al-Anon, and Al-Anon, in the world, there is this big spiritual movement. I think it'll be a big factor in changing the world. Now that sounds over optimistic, maybe, but it's the way I feel about it. One of the first out on volunteers was the father of a boy, and he was only too anxious to go along with Algon, and he went for it wholeheartedly. People were searching. I think parents and families of alcoholics are searching for something, so they're ready from that aspect. I think the principles of AA, they can be used by anybody that needs to change their life. It doesn't have to be associated with alcoholism necessarily. Of course, I may be prejudiced. In fact, I know I am prejudiced. But because I lived with Bill so many years, but I think he was very, very careful not to have any musts, any you ought, or you have to, or anything, those phrases, so that people can do what, or interpret the program as it appeals to them. I think the idea of authority, any authoritative program was carefully avoided. I don't know whether people know, but Bill studied. He studied all kinds of societies, the government and religious societies, Christian science, and any number of things. He spent a long, long time working out this setup for AA, so that it wouldn't be formalized, so that people could interpret it as they chose, so that there wouldn't be any real authority except the authority of God. Of course, as I said, I was prejudiced. But Bill never did anything without getting the approval of others in AA. He would send them all his ideas out to Akron, to Dr. Bob, and take the ideas down to the meetings in New York and discuss them. He had the cooperation and inspiration of others as well as himself.
This house that we're recording in now is called Stepping Stones. Can you tell me how that name?
Well, Bill and I were wondering what to call it after we came here. And at that time, there's 9 acres here now, at least 8.5 now. At that time, there was barely 2 acres when we first moved. And there was no room for a road to come up the house. The road had to zigzag up this hill here, the Rocky Hill. And we made steps up the rocks. And one day when Bill and I were out driving, we saw a place called itself Stepping Stones. And I thought, well, that's a good name for our place, because we do have a lot of steps to climb. And also, it has a little AA implication.
The house Stepping Stones here, and reveals an awful lot about your life. It's just an incredible atmosphere. And what it reveals to me is it's more than simply a home. It seems to reveal a philosophy. And I would really like to know a little bit about, you know, how it was, the decorating, and how there's an atmosphere of serenity about this place. Was this a conscious?
Well, it just wasn't a conscious, I think, except that I as consciously as make it as beautiful as I could under the circumstances. But after we moved in, I left Bill here sitting in the... We moved up in March, And we moved all the furniture, with barrels of china, and in the living room. Everything was in the living room. I tried to fix up the bedroom for him upstairs and the kitchen before I left. But I'd had an invitation to take a cruise on a freighter with the mother of one of the alcoholics. So we went on this freighter down to South America, and I left Bill in the middle of it. I mean, with all the furniture and everything in the middle, and went off to have a good time by myself. I always felt kind of guilty about that, because when I came back, he was quite sick with a cold. And this is an interesting aside. I mean, this is not Aldon. But he'd had the one time while I was away that he was tempted to drink. I think that was the only one time that he'd had. There wasn't any heat in the house. No furnace. There were two fireplaces, one upstairs and one down. But that's all. And it's a seven-room house. And that was not a... It isn't a very big house, except the rooms are very ample and comfortable. But he caught cold while I was away. And he got bad cough, and he went down to the drugstore and got himself cough medicine for his cold. And he took this cough medicine. And then he thought, oh my, after he'd taken several doses, because being alcoholic, he never took just one teaspoon. He took, you know, a good swig. So after a while, he began to think, well, no, this is a way. What I really need to cure my cold is a good shot of whiskey. That would take the cold away in no time. And then nobody would know about it, because here I am all by myself, and half the people don't know where we are. This is just the opportunity to do it. Lois would never know it. She's away. So then he suddenly thought, why am I thinking this way? I haven't thought this way for years and years. What made me think of it? And he looked at the bottle, and there was a certain percentage of alcohol. That little bit of alcohol that he'd taken into his system had changed his thinking. I think that's a very potent episode that happened. So, anyway, I did go, and I had a wonderful trip, and then we settled here in the house. But as I said, we didn't have any money to do anything. So I thought those three French doors at the front there should have something over them, but I couldn't afford. It was a lot of drapery to make that, to put those up, and I couldn't afford anything like that. So I painted on the wall. I painted drapes. And they really looked very nice. I had three swags that crossed each other, and then hung down. And I've been sorry ever since that I repainted it, because it makes a good story, and would be interesting, you know, just as a matter of... So I did all kinds of things like that. And I didn't tell earlier that I'd had occupational therapy training, so that I was adept with my hands. I could do this and that and the other thing. And I always liked to make things and to fix things up. So it came in very handy, because we didn't have any money for any furniture, but of course we had my family's, what I inherited from my family's furniture, and practically everything here except a few things are new, but most everything came from my family, and came really for several generations back. So it's old, and some of it was dilapidated. So it's been fixed up and mended to the best of my ability. So that's a detour of a house it's really old, isn't it? And we haven't gone out and bought any antiques. So I'm just a long time out on them. So I'm no celebrity. And if you hear that, anybody saying that, you can tell them she's not a celebrity. She's just a long time out. That just means that, for one thing, I'm at the moment, I'm past the age of most attendance at meetings, so that kind of sets me off as being something different. So going to an Al-Anon member, they assume I'm an early Al-Anon. So they want to hear from this early Al-Anon. Well, I would say I was active in Al-Anon up to a point, yes, but nowhere near as much as I used to be. I don't think I can ever not be, as long as I can crawl around. I live the program, that's being active in Al-Anon. At least I try to. And all my friends are AAs or Al-Anons. And I have gone to any number of different conventions and conferences and meetings. I'm just back from Akron, which is the city where AA was supposed to be founded, because it's where Bob and Bill met. And I was over in Geneva not too long ago. And I go here and there for Al-Anon. I mean, give Al-Anon talks. Sometimes just go, don't talk. But mostly I say a few words. I don't give any long talks. Although I gave quite a long talk in Akron just recently, 20 days ago. I'm an honorary member of the trustees, board of trustees and trustees. Occasionally, I don't go to all of them. And I go to the conference. That's the primary thing at the moment. I'm out working in the garden as many hours a day as I can. There's always something to be done in the garden. So, and I love music, I go to concerts, and I like my friends. I have quite a few friends that come to visit. Most of them are either AA or Al-Anon, although I have a few left. They're all, you know, when you get to be on an age like this, you don't have too many of your own generation. You have to pick up new friends if you don't have the old ones any longer. Never minded being alone at all. I read or I play the piano or I do something. Have something to make that you can't do when people are here. So I don't mind being alone at all. Of course, this Stepping Stones is now a foundation. Bill wanted to leave the place to AA and Al-Anon. Of course, he knew perfectly well the traditions because he was had written them down, a lot of them, so about AA and Al-Anon owning property. But he thought that it could be gotten around some way. So he wanted them to do it. So I've been trying to keep things up and keep them looking nice, and also in a number of cases, putting labels on them to tell where they came from, what they are, when they have any real interest. I don't think people think of this as a personal house. I think they think of it more as a museum or something like that, and that it belongs to them just as much as it belongs to me. That they have a right to see everything. I think they have that feeling about it. There's no good in starting a thing if it isn't carried on. The important thing is to carry it on. It's really what's going to tell the future.
What is your special message for the newcomer?
A special message for the newcomer?
To Al-Anon.
If you love, never give up hope. But if you don't love, why, that's something else. But if you do love, I think you should never give up.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. Please check out our website at www.sobrietytalks.com. Thank you.